The Constitution of the United States is comprised of 7 articles. Each article has a specific purpose, defining the federal government, how it will operate, and the authority and responsibility delegated by the Constitution to those various entities. The terms and conditions of the Constitution are very specific. They are limited, and the 9th and 10th Amendments to the Constitution reserve all of the powers not so delegated in the 7 articles to the states or to the people. In other words, the federal government is specifically limited. It is clear that the Founding Fathers intended that the federal government, as constituted, would be limited in scope and power. That was their intention. Protecting and preserving the rights of each of the 13 states at that time and any future states admitted to the Union. The Founding Fathers made it clear that the Constitution was determined, defined, and implemented by we the people of the United States. We the people. The Constitution was a people's document intended by the Founding Fathers and all men and women in the then less than perfect Union to form a more perfect Union and to establish justice. That was critical for them, their own justice, and to ensure domestic tranquility, peace among the people, and provide for the common defense, and promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and to our posterity. A wonderful beginning, don't you think? A more perfect union, establishing a new and more permanent kind of justice, ensuring domestic tranquility, peace among the states and foreign governments, providing for the common defense wherever necessary to accomplish constitutional objectives, promoting the general welfare, and securing the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Never hurts to repeat those words a second time, does it? Noble objectives all, and the reasons why the states gave up their individual rights so that, collectively, they together could form a more perfect union, a brand new United States of America. The Constitution of the United States in Article 2 provided for the establishment of the office of President of the United States of America, President. Hear the words of Article 2, Section 1. The executive power shall be vested in a President of the United States of America. He shall hold his office during the term of 4 years and together with a Vice President chosen for the same term. 4 years. 4 years to serve as President and then, in 1791 and beyond, subject to re-election or the return to private citizenship, preferably the latter. Interesting how Section 1 refers to the President as he. The Founders never contemplated a she ever being President. I wonder their reaction when there is some good possibility she, Hillary Clinton, may become President of the United States. May have to amend that. In the course of American history since 1787, no President had ever been elected for more than 2 terms. In fact, First President George Washington steadfastly believed that he, as well as other presidents, should not serve more than 2 terms, even if re-elected to a 3rd term would be possible. But then came Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who was elected, then elected to a 2nd term, and then a 3rd, and even a 4th term as president, where he died in office. And that led to the ratification of the 22nd Amendment, ratified February 27, 1951. And that forbade any citizen of the United States from holding the office of president for more than 2 terms. Not 12 years, nor 16 years, as FDR had hoped. Section 1 of Article 2 further states emphatically that no person shall be eligible to be elected to the office of president unless that person is a natural-born citizen. There were many who thought in 2008, and do so today, that Barack Hussein Obama was not, in fact, a natural-born citizen of the United States, and should, as a result, not have been eligible, unqualified, for election as president, no matter the alleged birth certificate he produced from the state of Hawaii. There has even in this election 2016 been accusations that candidate Ted Cruz was not a natural-born citizen, but apparently that notion has been dispelled. Further, says the Constitution, Article 2, Section 1, you should read that very carefully. In order to be eligible to be elected as president, you, the candidate, must be at least 35 years old, and the candidate must have been 14 years a resident within the United States. In those early constitutional days, lifespan was much shorter than today. Education and maturity factors were different. Sufficient, thought the Founding Fathers, for election, having attained the age of 35. That's all. Perhaps Barack Hussein Obama is a modern-day version of that age requirement, elected president as a man in his late 40s, perhaps equivalent to 35 of old. And Article 2, Section 1 provides even more. That, should the president be removed from office, impeachment, perhaps, or death, or resignation, or inability, disability, to discharge the powers and duties of the office, the vice president shall succeed permanently in the event of death, resignation, or impeachment, permanently, but only temporarily in the event of disability, the elected president being restored to office when the disability has been removed. In any such case, one can see how critically important the choice of vice president by the president can be, for that citizen, male or female, could very well become the president permanently or acting president in any of those 4 years. And now come Clinton and either Trump or Cruz, presumptive nominees, and one of these three will very well be the next president of our beloved United States. And we, my fellow citizens, should watch ever so carefully the choice made by the candidate for vice president. As voters, we should require that the citizen chosen should be, in our voting estimation, fully qualified to lead our great country. We, the people, can elect the nominees and ultimately elect the president himself or herself. But we have little or no influence or input with regard to the choice of a vice president by any candidate. But again, that choice for vice president should very much influence our vote, because we may be voting for him or her as a president of the United States. So then, we the people elect a president. Before that citizen enters on the execution of his office, he shall take the following oath or affirmation. Hear the words of the Constitution. I do solemnly swear or affirm that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. So that the first and primary duty of the newly elected President is to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution. Not interpret it. Not find ways to work around it, not to exploit gray areas or add definition to the rights, privileges, and duties granted by the Constitution, Mr. Obama, but only to preserve, protect, and defend the document as is. So many think Barack Hussein Obama, supposedly a constitutional student and even expert, has done anything but. In fact, in so many ways, his administration has ignored the Constitution, reinterpreted it, challenged the states and the Supreme Court with executive orders and agency actions, and otherwise sought to radically redefine or eviscerate the clear demands of this great document and its amendments. What do you think? And under his rulership, there is more to come. 9 months more, oh my soul. I can only wonder what's going to happen. And there are powers granted by the Constitution expressly and implicitly to the President to issue presidential orders, so-called executive orders. As the President is charged with the implementation of the Constitution and the enforcement of the laws and the legislation of the federal government, and with respect to the functioning of federal agencies, the President can issue executive orders which have the force and effect of law. Those executive orders can even circumvent the law, ignore the plain wording, reinterpret meaning, and even establish new policy. No president in the history of the United States has issued more or more radical executive orders than Barack Hussein Obama. With in his words, his phone and his pen. Obama has preempted much of the authority of Congress, the House and Senate, and he has often ignored judicial precedent and implemented his very own philosophies and priorities wherever possible, so often without regard to constitutional or legislative requirements. This president has often disrespectfully ignored Congress and operated independently of the legislative body, often with impunity. The constitutional checks and balances with regard to the House and Senate of Congress and the Supreme Court are ignored as this president takes the offensive by issuing his far-reaching executive orders. The Founding Fathers never intended such power to be involved in any executive order. The Constitution requires a full respect of states' rights by the federal government and by its agencies, and of course the Supreme Court, as constitutionally determined in Amendments 9 and 10. Read those amendments. Amendments 9 and 10 to the Constitution. The executive order syndrome of Obama has ignored those rights and treated the rights of the states, the 50 states, guaranteed by the Constitution in disrespectful ways, evoking the so-called powers of the president through executive orders to accomplish his Obama objectives. Consequently, constitutionality, the rule of law, the balance of powers, and especially states' rights are now all in disarray. And a certain governmental chaos exists, federal and state. Litigation everywhere. The Supreme Court has more suits asking for decision than ever before. Demands upon that court for final interpretation and resolution of so many problems, so that in de facto ways, the country is ruled by six people. Six. Think about that. Our country is ruled by six people. The President of the United States and at least five of the justices of a Supreme Court of the United States making a decision, a permanent legal decision. That's a total of six. Isn't that unbelievable? Such a state of affairs in America today was never intended or even comprehended by the Founding Fathers. It is, many think, the executive power of the United States run wild, Mr. Obama. A president out of control, and executive orders trumping legislation and the rule of law at the whim of one man. Some doubt that constitutional order and balance will ever be restored. We the people then live in uncertainty, unsure how to plan our lives, or how the laws, the rules, and the regulations of our country will change virtually at any time. How can you live under those circumstances? That fosters a certain chaos and civil unrest, which many think may eventually lead to civil disobedience. I hope and pray it doesn't happen, but it very well may. One man, exercising the powers of the most powerful office in the world in unconstitutional ways, can radically change the rights, the privileges, and the duties of we the people at any time. Scary stuff. And then comes Article 2, Section 2. The first words read as follows. The President shall be Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy of the United States and of the militia of the several states when called into the actual service of the United States. The Army, the Navy, and the militia, the National Guards. Think then, my fellow citizens, of the awesome, the unbelievable power invested in the President to make decisions, ultimate decisions for the functioning of the military of the United States. This president, Obama, or any president, has the power and authority to order the use of a nuclear bomb. Wow. Atomic weaponry of any kind, a double wow. The president can order the Army and Navy, as well as the militia, to go to war, invade, protect and defend, and otherwise use the armed services as he thinks right. The president can appoint those who are philosophically and politically akin and aligned to him and to his personal philosophies. In the case of our current president, the armed forces have become overtly politically correct. There are constant attacks against Christianity and perhaps all religions, and the profession of faith in the services. Keep your mouth shut. Chaplains are harassed. American warriors are chastised, even court-martialed for expressions of faith, no matter the constitutional rights to do so. Punishments grow. Intolerance seems everywhere. And that includes fostering the gay agenda, often with preferences to the rights of any in the services who are LGBT. Military budgets are often frozen or fundamentally and strategically changed in accordance with the priorities of the president. This current president, Obama, wants to reduce the might and power of our military forces, and consequently military budgets have been restricted or reduced. Many are concerned about the defense of our country, especially with nuclear capabilities, even on the part of terrorists. And now the current capability of intercontinental ballistic missiles, nuclear-armed, on the part of warmongering nations to reach and wreak havoc on American soil. Can you believe that? Are we properly defended against that? This day and age requires the most sophisticated, modern, and state-of-the-art military awareness and preparedness. But this commander-in-chief neutralizes and fails to invest in the American military in all of its forms as the dangers of this modern world require. So we the people now think in terms of quite likely Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump or Ted Cruz becoming our president in November. Commander-in-chief in November. Commander-in-chief of the armed services. Commander-in-Chief Cruz, Commander-in-Chief Clinton, Commander-in-Chief Trump. Which of those three would you invest with the awesome power and responsibility of ordering the explosion, the detonation of a nuclear bomb or defending against one? Which one? That determination should be uppermost in your mind as you cast your vote in November. Which of these three candidates would be better in the awesome responsibility of protecting, preserving, and defending this great country and we the people, as the Constitution requires? Which one? The future of our great country depends upon the right choice. It really does. As Commander-in-Chief, there are few checks and balances as military decisions are made. There is considerable discretion in the president, even though the Constitution infers collaboration, joint decision-making between the president and the Congress, especially in the case of declaring war. And sometimes that occurs. But more often, the president can and will act independently, without advice or consultation, and as he wishes. One man, one president, initiated the war in Iraq. George Bush alone made the decision for our country to go to war against Saddam Hussein and the country of Iraq. One man. Ah, yes, he got some advice, but he made that decision. That independent, perhaps arbitrary decision, why did Bush make that decision? Resulted in America, we the people, investing billions and billions of dollars in warfare rather than the constitutionally required general welfare. And that resulted in the loss of thousands of lives, whether military or civilian, including the lives of thousands, tens of thousands of innocents, children and women, all as the result of the decision of one man, one president. Congress funds the military, establishes budgets, but once done, Congress has little authority or check and balance as military decisions are made. In, then, a military sense, the president can exercise autocratic, even dictatorial powers and decision-making, which can drastically and dramatically affect the lives of 330 million Americans. We the people. We have no say in that decision-making. We are never consulted, nor are we allowed to vote on that decision. The motto and meaning of "In God We Trust" is transferred to "In Him." In Him we trust. We have no choice or recourse other than impeachment, which is almost impossible, not to mention time-consuming, and war happens real fast.